Time to take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Should take a look at my health. I've got a little bit of a cold here that I cannot shake, and I am sorry that I'm sick, but do dogs get cold or cats get colds?
Cats and dogs can get upper respiratory infections, and we see them quite commonly in cats. They're usually, there's one in the herpes family, which is not contagious to people.
Yeah.
It's called rhinotracheitis. There's another one called Khaleesi virus, and it can cause, you know, runny eyes, runny nose, and so on. And that's one of the reasons why we vaccinate our pets, just to try to prevent them from getting some of these diseases.
Well, I don't know. Maybe I need a vaccination.
Maybe. I don't know. But, you know, it's not our colds can't be transmitted to our dogs and cats.
Yeah. That's the good news.
Right.
John in Green Bay has a question for you. So let's go to John. Hi, John.
Good morning or good afternoon.
Hello.
Jana.
Okay.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry for that mispronunciation there, Jana. What can we do for you?
Not a problem. I have managed to capture a cat that has been wandering around my neighborhood for quite some time. I have no idea who this cat belongs to. She's very, very shy, and she doesn't seem to have her balance. She tips her head to the left,
mm-hmm.
and if she shakes her head or moves too quickly, she tips over.
Okay.
And unfortunately, I can't keep her. I already have three cats, and I just can't bring another cat into the house. But I didn't know if I should take her to a humane shelter
mm-hmm.
or just what I can
do. Yeah, what to do.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it sounds like with her having a balance problem, first things that we would want to do is have a look in her ear. Sometimes cats that are out in the wild, we'll get ear mites and nasty ear infections that can spread from the outer part of the ear into the middle ear cavity. And it may be something as simple as that to be treated. But there are other diseases that can affect a cat as well. There's actually a condition that we start seeing usually a little bit later in the summer where we don't know what causes it, whether it's viral or just what causes it. But cats will suddenly develop nystagmus, which is the flicking of the eyes as if they were on the tilt-a-whirl, and develop a head tilt. And we call it idiopathic feline vestibular disease, because
Whoa.
We don't know what causes it. And vestibular is just the fancy word for balance apparatus. So it's possible it could be something like that. She's a stray. She could have been hit by a car and had some damage. But I think the first thing would be she does need to get some veterinary attention. If depending on the community that you live in, some of the shelters do have veterinarians on staff, and they will obviously put the cat through the paces to make sure that they're healthy and happy and perhaps treatable before they're put up for a adoption. So call your shelter and let them know that you have found this kitty. And, you know, hopefully they have somebody there that can help you out.
I bet they do in Green Bay.
I would bet that they do.
Of that.
Okay. I feel so bad for her. She seems like she's just very shy and timid,
mm-hmm.
and I imagine she's been wandering around for a while. I've checked with all the neighbors, and nobody's ever seen this cat before.
And she could just be a stray that's ended up in your area that has not had a lot of human contact. It's also one of the things that the shelter will do is scan the pet for a microchip, and this is something that is becoming more and more popular, and many shelters, before they even adopt a pet out, will microchip, and it's available also to consumers to have their own pets microchipped. And, you know, they'll scan to see if she has a microchip, and maybe if she's one of those few lucky cats that's already been microchipped, they can reunite her with her former owners.
That'd be good. Good luck. Thanks very much, Jana, for calling. Appreciate it. Well, Donna in Whitefish Bay is online, so let's go to Donna. Hi, Donna.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
You're welcome.
I have two Somalis, two cats, a male and a female, and they're wonderful cats. I love them. This morning, a chipmunk found its way into my home, and my female was on that chipmunk immediately, just attacked it, held it for the longest time, but did not kill it. She does mouse occasionally, but tends not to kill the animals.
Mm-hmm.
She just likes to, you know, hold them in her mouth. So this chipmunk is now in my residence, and I'm wondering, do chipmunks carry rabies? We have various animals where I live, and I know that raccoons tend to be rabid, but
right.
Is it possible that the chipmunk could carry that as well?
Very, very unlikely. The big animals that carry rabies here, besides our own domestic animals like cats and dogs and horses and cows and so on, which happens rarely, of the wildlife, raccoons, bats and skunks would be the big things I'd be thinking about. Because of their natural, you know, eating habits and so on, little chipmunks and things tend to be eating seeds and things like that on the ground. They're not usually put in a situation of coming in contact with rabies. And so it would be, if it is reported, I know that there was one report in Canada of a rodent that ended up picking up rabies, but it's extremely rare to have that be a problem. I have to tell you, though, my chipmunk story. This is getting a little off topic, but I'm a mildly hypertensive and they put me on new blood pressure medication and I'm at my kitchen, you know, getting my stuff ready to go to work, and a chipmunk got into my house. Same story. My cat caught it, and I all of a sudden I hear this little meow and turn around, and he dropped this chipmunk. It ran up my pant leg.
Oh, no.
And I'm on the way to the doctor to get my blood pressure checked. Well, you know, I ended up dropping a colander over it when I got it cornered in my pantry, slid a plate underneath, got it outside, and the thing escaped, and everything was fine. But let's just say my blood pressure was not decreased on that next recheck. So, you know, so don't wear baggy pants if you have a chipmunk in your house. That's the moral of the story. But try to get it out of there. The thing I'd be worried about is, you know, do they have fleas or anything like that that could be causing more problems?
Good luck, Donna. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Oh, my goodness. Bob and Barron's up next. Hi, Bob. Thank you for calling.
How are you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What can we do for you?
I got a 5-week-old Shih Tzu puppy, and the brother passed away, and the girl, it just, when it eats, when it drinks a little bit, it'll act like it's gagging and not getting air.
Mm-hmm.
And then it'll go real limp for a while, and then we'll force feed her a little bit more, and then she'll get a little bit lively again.
Oh, wow. Wow. Now, is this a puppy that you bred or that you...
Yeah.
Okay. So this, you've got the mom at home.
Yeah.
I would be concerned about a couple things. Shih Tzus are one of the breeds that have the very pushed-in face, and they are sometimes more prone, just because of the anatomy that they've been born with, of having a cleft palate. The hard surface on the roof of their mouth may have a hole in it or a defect that allows milk and things to get into the respiratory tract and could be causing the puppy to have trouble breathing. It's also possible that just the fact that this puppy may have what's called stenotic nares, very tiny nostrils. They can be born with an extra small nose. In those puppies, it's very difficult for them to eat and breathe at the same time. And sometimes we're looking at surgically opening up those nostrils to allow the puppy to be able to breathe normally.
Yeah, it is a real tiny puppy.
Yeah, I think I would be recommending that, even though it's only 5 weeks of age and it's not at a point where you'd be thinking about vaccinating it, this is a puppy that needs to be seen by a veterinarian. I'd be worried about other things too, like heart disease, you know, significant heart murmurs or anything like that that could be affecting the dog's ability to just function normally. The fact that it's passing out has me... And
it doesn't pass out. It just goes limp.
Yeah, well, going limp, whatever. I mean, this is a time in a puppy's life where they're go, 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 and then they sleep, and this is not normal puppy behavior. So get this little puppy checked out right away.
Get the dog to the vet.
That's correct.
Thank you for calling. Mark in Cornucopia, your turn. Hi, Mark. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm actually today down by Lafarge, and it's soggy out here.
No, I bet.
I have a cat, Mo, who I adopted from the Humane Center in Madison, and you talked about the radio chips, and I have two problems with Mo. One, and the vets have looked at him, never found any explanation, but he's licked all his belly hair off and can't get him to stop. And the other is, he had this chip. I adopted him in about 6 months, and there was quite a pronounced lump, actual lump, on his neck. And most of the swelling went down after many months, but it's still very pronounced, and once in a while it will even have like a little scab over it that it's so, you know, affecting the surface of the skin. I read in an article somewhere about an adverse reactions that were happening with these chips, that there were actually tumors, and I don't know if they were malignant tumors or, what they were talking about. I'm wondering if you can explain the risks and benefits of these chips.
And did you have the chip put in, or was it in when you...
Their policy, as Sandy was saying, at the Humane Society in Madison, is to chip all their animals prior to adoption.
Yeah, and the chips themselves are coated. They're a tiny thing about the size of a grain of rice, very, very non-reactive. And so we rarely ever see any problems unless there is, when they've done the microchipping, carried in some infection or something else that's caused some problems. The most likely reason why your cat had a lump in that area of the neck as well would be vaccines. That's why vaccines are now given primarily in the limbs of cats. We rarely ever like to give injections up over the trunk because some cats, and it's about 1 to 5 in 10,000 cats, so it's very low odds, can develop a tumor at the injection site where vaccines have gone in. The fact that this is opening and draining and scabbing over, it would be easy enough to take a quick x-ray and see if the microchip, because they do show up on x-ray, is in the area of this lump. If it is, then it may be a reason to say, well, let's go in and remove this diseased tissue and get it out of there. If it, you know, the microchip isn't there, then we'd start looking at other reasons. And maybe an indication to get this area biopsied to make sure that it isn't something more evil like a fibrosarcoma that could be causing the cat some problems. Very unlikely that the microchip has absolutely anything to do with your cat licking the hair off its belly. We do see cats over-grooming. We used to think that cats that would do this, we would, you know, just chalk it up to psychological problems, like a human biting their fingernails to the quick. They would just sit Buddha style and over-groom their belly to the point that their belly is raw. We now recognize that most of these cats that are doing this excessive grooming or barbering of their hair coat probably have some underlying medical problem. Your cat came from a shelter. Infectious diseases like there's a Demodex mite that can affect cats may not show up with any other skin changes except for over-grooming, but this would be something that your veterinarian may be able to diagnose on skin scrapings, may go through a trial of therapy to see if it is something that will respond to treatment that would be effective for getting these mites. I know that the Dane County Humane Society screens all of their cats for ringworm, which is a fungus that affects the skin and can sometimes cause cats to overgroom as well. Allergies, I mean, the list goes on and on and on. But the fact that it came from a shelter, I'd be more worried about contagious things. So again, time to go back to your veterinarian and say, hey, let's deal with this lump, try to figure out what it is because I'm worried about it. And by the way, what's going on with the skin and start that workup as well.
Dan, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Talking Your Pet's Health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor in the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You can join in, too, if you have a question about your pet's health at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Larry Mueller here with Sandy Sawchuk. And Sandy, there's just some terrible news here the last few days with all of the water and Lake Delton emptying.
Yeah.
Wondering about pets, you know, I don't think anybody lost a pet. I didn't hear about it.
Well, there was actually, it depends on what you classify as pets, but right here in Blooming Grove, which is a community just outside of Madison, there was a large farm that I was reading this morning lost multiple animals that were in barns, goats and different things too, that were actually family pets and quite sad. Nice article in the paper showing that, you know, most of her farm's underwater, including the buildings that her large animal pets were housed in. So it can happen. And I think going back to this microchipping business, you know, you never know when they're going to lose their collars or if something's going to happen. I lost a tree in my backyard and thank goodness it didn't land on my fence because I have a dog door and if I didn't realize it, my dogs could have just walked right over the tree and out they went if the fence was knocked down. So always keeping ID on your pets if possible. And, you know, we're concerned too about the quality of water, not only for humans. Right. They're recommending that we get our wells checked and so on because of flooding. You know, not letting your pets drink from standing water because, you know, who knows what's in it. And we'd be worried about disease transmission. So trying to make sure that they're drinking clean water just like we are.
Okay. Chelsea in Minocqua has a question for you, so let's go to Chelsea. Hi, Chelsea.
Hi. Yes, I have a question. I have an 11-month Boston Terrier, and I've been in and out of the vet with dealing with skin irritations. He has patches where he is bald in the middle of his back, and now he, on the back of his thighs, he's losing hair. Hmm. And he's been on numerous antibiotics. He was actually treated for mange about a month or so ago, and that ended up not being the case.
Okay.
And now he was put on hypoallergenic food, and he was put on prednisone. So I guess I'm just wondering if there's some sort of topical ointment I can use for him, or if you've heard of anything like this before.
Yeah, I mean, it sure sounds like when we see patchy hair loss like that, the big things that come to my mind, one would be a mange mite, and you said he was treated, but there are multiple different types of mites that dogs can get. And one that I get really concerned about, because it can take months of therapy to clear it, is one called Demodex. And it's a mite that lives down in the hair follicles. It's a little harder to find than some of the other mites because you have to kind of squeeze the skin when you're doing deep skin scrapings. I would hope that your veterinarian has done that. And treatment for that requires, usually we're looking at either, you know, weekly dips or daily oral medications to try to get the mite under control. Bacterial infections can also present like this, and especially in short-haired dogs, they may not have the typical pimples and scabs like we would see in other breeds of dogs. And with these little short-haired dogs, we'll sometimes see these hairless circular patches, especially over their back. And again, appropriate antibiotics for the appropriate amount of time. I'm just as guilty as the next one of thinking, oh, we can get this cleared up really fast. But in many skin infections, you're looking at 3 to 4 weeks, if not longer, of an oral antibiotic to try to get it under control.
Okay.
Ringworm would also be something. Remember, ringworm is not a worm. It's a fungus, kind of like athlete's foot.
Mm-hmm.
And having him cultured for ringworm would be a good idea. That can take 2 or 3 weeks to come back, to get the culture report back. And in the meantime, your veterinarian may make some recommendations of some dips and things like that if they're really suspicious of it. But I know you've been in and out to the veterinarian. It may be time, if your vet can't find the answer for this, that you think about either a visit to a specialist in dermatology, or, you know, maybe your veterinarian can refer you to someone who maybe not a specialist, but who has a strong interest in dermatology and wants to jump through all the hoops that needs to be done to get an answer for you.
Yeah.
Okay. And you said something about being pimples, and he did have pimples apparent on his back at one point with this patch.
Okay, okay. So it's very possible that he may have just a chronic bacterial infection. Remember, many of the infections we're dealing with are staph organisms, and staph are notorious for being difficult to get under control. There's only certain antibiotics that we can use, and it's important to use it for the right length of time. And, you know, a week to 10 days is not going to be enough. You're looking at 3 to 4 weeks minimum to get under control.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Good luck.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And you can also email us at talk@wpr.org, and we can do it that way as well. Bill in Monona is up next. So let's go to Bill. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Thank you. I'm calling about our 9-year-old Lhasa Apso, who we've had for since she was born and is in very good health. She's never had a problem. But last evening, when my wife took her out for a walk, she noticed what appeared to be some blood in her urine.
Oh.
So that when we took her out again this morning, we looked, and sure enough, it wasn't bright red, but there appeared to be blood in the urine again. And as she lifts her leg to urinate, the leg shakes a whole lot more than we've seen it in the last 9 years.
Okay.
We're trying to get her into a vet, Sandy, but what do we look for? What does the vet look for? What should we be thinking of?
Well, being a female dog, urinary tract infections would be the most common thing that we would be considering. It's important that you try to get her in with a urine sample right in her bladder. We want a sterile sample. And so letting her walk in and hit the grass outside the clinic or urinate on the floor of the clinic can be a problem, because we want a sterile sample. So hold her in your lap, carry her in, keep her leash short, and maybe if you use a carrier or crate, you can confine her for an hour or two, a couple hours before the appointment, so we have a better chance of getting a sterile urine sample. Depending on what they see on that, and part of the exam, too, will be to actually feel the bladder and look for kidney pain or bladder discomfort. We may have bladder stones there as well. Not so much kidney stones, but we do see dogs developing, we do see kidney stones once in a while in dogs, but more commonly, actually, stones occurring in the bladder that can be knocking around in there, sometimes caused by infection, sometimes just the dog's own physical makeup can cause them to start secreting minerals and cause stones to occur. So that might be something your veterinarian would be recommending if they are suspicious after feeling the bladder that they may have to get an X-ray to see if there's any bladder stones in there. So just be prepared for that. A urine sample for your analysis, probably a urine culture, and maybe an X-ray of her bladder. And this might be something, if you can't get into your veterinarian in a timely manner like today, then you may be wanting to look at going to an emergency clinic. Even though this is not a life and death emergency, it's very uncomfortable for the dog. And that may be why her leg is shaking, that she's, in a little discomfort. Yeah, as the bladder's spasming. So time to get her in right away.
All right.
Thank you very much. Yep. We'll attempt to do that.
Okay.
Thanks, Bill, for calling. Appreciate it. And Ann in Manitowoc's up next. Hi, Ann.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I have three Labrador Retrievers. I have 2 7-year-olds, and just recently I got a puppy, a little yellow lab. And the problem that I have is with my 7-year-old Black. He has had chronic ear infections basically all 7 years that we've had him.
Mm-hmm.
The vet has tried every topical. We've tried several antibiotics. He did actually develop a couple cysts or tumors in the ear canal, which they removed. They came back benign, which was certainly a good
mm-hmm.
thing,
mm-hmm.
but the ear infections persisted. The vet actually cauterized his ears.
Huh.
And after the cauterization, what the vet was trying to achieve is make that acute infection or a chronic, make it acute so it could be treated. And I have to say it was marvelous. His ears never looked as good as after, he healed from that cauterization.
Okay.
However, 2 weeks later, we're right back where we were before.
Right back to the same thing.
Yeah, yeah.
He's tried now a fourth generation. It's an injectable antibiotic, which should, be in his blood system for 14 days.
Yeah.
But we're having no success with that. And he's now talking about a couple procedures. One is a ZEP procedure,
yep.
where they actually change the
yep.
ear canal.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, he's hoping that that will be effective. If not, he's actually talking about, removing the actual ear canal
right.
and closing off the ear. And I guess I wanted your opinion on those procedures.
Okay. Ears are, from my standpoint as a small animal veterinarian, probably one of the most difficult things to try to get under control in a lot of cases, because the dog's anatomy is such that their ear canal is almost J-shaped. It goes straight down and then in. Anytime you've got swelling and chronic changes in the ear with scar tissue, it just keeps becoming a vicious cycle. You treat it, and then you get more scarring, and then the ear canal gets narrower, which causes more infection. I don't know what kind of diagnostic work has been done, but when we keep seeing these infections coming back over and over again, a couple things that you may want to be looking into before you jump into doing these major surgeries. One would be to get a CAT scan, a CT scan of your dog's skull. This obviously has to be done under general anesthesia. They don't lay in the machine wide awake. What we'd be doing is looking for bony changes or changes in the middle ear cavity to see if you've got a middle ear infection. Many dogs that have chronic ear changes are missing their eardrum, and if the ear canal is swollen, we can't get in there adequately to be able to have a good look with your standard otoscope, so we sometimes have to resort to using special diagnostic tests like a CT scan. The other thing that can be done to get a better idea of how the ear canal is looking way down and deep is using a video otoscope. It's kind of like a doctor that would look in your joint with a video, like an arthroscope, to have a look and see what's going on, a fine little camera that goes down in there. I know the vet school, our dermatology department, Dr. DeBoer is the only one in the clinic that's trained to use this, but that's something that he's done and is able to get in and have a look at these ears and collect appropriate samples to make sure that it's being treated appropriately. The drug that your veterinarian has put your dog on, the new one that's just out, it's called Convenia. It's made by Pfizer. It's a very effective antibiotic for many infections. but you don't know until you get adequate cultures. And I don't know if your veterinarian has been doing cultures on your dog's ear to make sure that it is one that would be an appropriate bug to use. We've been seeing more and more cases of MRSA in dogs, methicillin-resistant staph infections, although in dogs, it doesn't tend to be MRSA, which is Staph aureus. We get MRSA-I, Staph intermedius. But they're almost identical in that it just looks at antibiotics and laughs at them. And we're running out of drugs that we can use to be treating these dogs. So it comes down to, after 7 years of doing all this, before you jump in and do surgery, you need to get some other diagnostic workup done. Cultures, video otoscope, CT scan to see what's going on. Because just doing a lateral ear canal resection, which is the ZAP, where they take off part of the wall of the ear canal to open up the horizontal part of the ear canal, may or may not work, depending on what's going on in the middle ear cavity. And doing a TECA, a total ear canal ablation, would be contraindicated if you've got middle ear infection, because you'll just be locking that infection down in that middle ear cavity. So I don't know a veterinarian that would jump in and start doing these procedures without having all this other testing done.
Okay.
I do have one other question, a little on the lighter side. With this new puppy that I brought in, both of my 7-year-olds are actually on light food because they both are a little on the heavy side.
Mm-hmm.
And just, I'm having a real difficult time. She wants to eat their food, and of course they want to eat hers. Trying to keep them out of hers because they don't need the frosted flakes.
Oh, yeah.
But is there any harm in her eating the light food? She's 11 weeks old.
It's not meant for growth. It doesn't have high enough fat levels, and it probably has not the right mineral levels and so on to support growth as well. And this just comes down to, when you've got multiple pets, you need multiple seats at the restaurant. And keeping them in their crates during mealtime, not leaving food out 24 hours a day. I don't know if you are free feeding your dogs, but that's really hard with three pets to have food down 24 hours a day. So separating them during mealtime, putting the puppy in its crate in another room so that it doesn't have the stress of, you know, wondering if a big dog's going to come over and try to steal their food. That way you can control the calorie intake of your older dogs, and the puppy's going to be getting the appropriate food it needs as well. So it comes down to, it's the human that needs to intervene. So don't change the diet, just change your habits.
And good luck, Ann. Thank you very much for your call. Well, let me see here. Marilyn in Kansasville is up next. So let's see. Let's go there. Hi, Marilyn.
Good morning. I have a 12-year-old, we're guessing, 12-year-old domestic short hair whose name is Gray. But anyway, he is well cared for, and all his inoculations are up to date. Now, we take him outside, not unattended. He wears harness and leash. And he's in the yard with us briefly a couple times a day. He walks around the house and reads his P-mail, so to
speak.
Yes,
right.
But now, yesterday, I had him out, and after the rain had stopped, and even though he gets plenty of good water in the house, he was enjoying drinking casual water from the patio and from the yard.
Uh-huh.
Now, and we put a halt to that as much as possible, but he certainly was enjoying it. But I'm wondering, are his current inoculations enough to prevent a problem? Or, because I remember years ago we had a Labrador, and I remember he had inoculations to prevent, leptospirosis from drinking casual water?
Yep.
Now, does the cat need something like that?
We don't have a vaccine for cats. They tend to not be a species that gets that disease. It's a waterborne bacteria that we do see more in dogs, and people can get so on. But there is no licensed vaccine for cats. What I'd be more concerned about with your cat would be things like pesticides and herbicides coming off the lawn and being in the standing water. Perhaps this is just a time where you have to say, well, you know, it just rained. We're going to wait a few hours for things to evaporate a little bit before we put you outside. And how good of you to keep your cat on a leash. And, you know, I'd be concerned about things like heartworm disease, making sure...
try and avoid that.
Yeah, but keeping your cat on a heartworm preventative, it's going outside, that has me concerned too, because with all this water, we're going to have lots of mosquitoes. And with lots of mosquitoes, that's the intermediate host for a parasite called heartworm, which can be a fatal disease in cats. So talk to your veterinarian about a heartworm, flea, and tick preventative.
Can you imagine the explosion in mosquitoes in about the next week?
I don't even want to think about
it. Oh, my goodness.
I don't want to think about it. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Marilyn, for calling. Marie in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Marie. Are you there?
Oop, we lost Marie.
We lost Marie. Well, that's all right. We'll just go on to Suzanne, who's online from Florida, listening to us online. Hi, wow. Suzanne.
Hi, guys. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have sort of a question and a comment. We adopted two kittens down here, and basically, right from the get-go, one of them, she started off with an upper respiratory infection, was very, very ill for quite some time. The other one never caught it. She was fine. They were both treated. Now that they're a little bit older, our black one, the one that had the upper respiratory infection, she's quite heavy. She's actually about 17 pounds now.
Ooh, geez.
And she snores a lot.
That's big. Yeah. She snores a lot,
Yeah, mm-hmm. She snores. And I was wondering if that could be either because of her weight or maybe related to the upper respiratory infection she had when she was a kitten.
It could be both.
Yeah,
the cats and dogs that are overweight or are blessed with the pushed-in face. I have two bulldogs at home, they are actually a good model for sleep apnea. And I listen to them, and they like stop breathing and then start up again and so on. Maybe that's why they fall asleep, all day long, too. But obesity can cause some respiratory distress as they, because they gain weight everywhere, not just in their belly, but around their neck and their throat area. And so when your cat relaxes, these tissues probably relax and can start vibrating as they're breathing while they're sleeping. Respiratory problems that cats pick up as kittens are usually viral, and then they go from being viral to having enough damage done to their nasal linings that they get secondary bacterial infections. And these infections can be bad enough that you can lose some of the structures, what are called the turbinates, the bony scrolls in the nose that filter the air, and have some scarring and some changes there. And we can see cats with chronic sinus infections. I would be expecting that if it was all related to your cat's past health issues, that you'd be seeing some nasal discharge, some sneezing, open mouth breathing, maybe, green mucus coming out of nostrils, more, things like that periodically to lead us down the road that we've got a problem with maybe chronic sinus infection. So if you're not seeing that, then I think that it's probably all weight related. And that is something you can definitely do something about.
You can do something about
fewer calories
that.
And more exercise. Yeah.
And that's probably, it's just such an odd, just like humans, I'm sure everybody has their own metabolism, but we barely feed them anything. And she just keeps on gaining weight, and the other one stays the same. And,
Genetics is a wonderful thing. And and one of the things that we found, and you may want to talk to your veterinarian about this, is the diets that many cats go on can be a little too low in protein to support high enough metabolism for weight loss. So we're finding that cats that need to lose weight may do better on, pardon the pun, but a catkins diet. A high protein, low fat, low carbohydrate diet helps support lean body tissue, improves their metabolism. But, you still have to use a measured amount of that food and just feed them, the appropriate amount to support her lean body weight, not her fat body weight, but what she should weigh, and then adding in lots of exercise as well. So toys on strings and wands, getting her to run up and down the stairs with a laser pointer, whatever it takes to get her up and moving. And that's going to take you being involved.
and you don't feed them. Do you feed them at the same time, or is the one eating some of the other ones?
Well,
actually,
we do feed them at the same. They get one little tiny can. They share a can of like fancy feasts in the morning, and then we give them like 3/4 of a cup of dry food to share at night, and that's all they eat.
Okay,
and she just keeps getting bigger.
Yeah, and
we have heard about the high protein thing, and we're actually started this week in the transition of trying to get them, onto a more high protein food.
Good, good. And then also feeding them separately because it's very difficult to regulate how much food she's taking in compared to
she's
the other one.
She's getting her share and then some.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
If you guys don't mind, you had an earlier caller that was, you spoke about a tumor and that can be caused by injection site.
Uh-huh.
This poor little one, the black one that I'm speaking of right now, she had a tumor from an injection site. And just let your previous caller know, we had very good luck. They removed the tumor. They got all the abnormal cells, and obviously she's fat and happy. So
good. And see, that's the problem when these injections are made in spots like over the back. You have to take wide surgical margins, and these little tumors are like an octopus with little tentacles of tissue that come out, which is why the American Association of Feline Practitioners has been recommending that the location of all vaccines should be, they should be placed in a limb. So if you do run into troubles, you can save the cat's life potentially by amputating the limb if you need to. So a nice thing to have happen.
No.
Yes, exactly. Thank you, guys.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Suzanne, for calling, and thanks for listening from Florida. Appreciate it very much. Wherever you're listening, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234 or in the Madison area at 263-1890. We have some open lines. We'll get you on pretty fast. John in Winter is up next. Hi, John. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Doc.
Hi.
Yeah, I talked to you before. I had a Lavra healer that died from Lyme.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, I took the plunge and I got another puppy.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah, well, she's 8 months old, and she's a border collie mix.
Okay.
And she was an outside dog. Now she's going to be inside. But the reason I'm calling is I kind of don't like her name.
Okay.
I was thinking about changing her name.
Mm-hmm.
Is that going to be a real deal?
Well, what's her name now?
Her name's Coley.
Coley? Okay.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of colon.
Okay, yeah.
And you want to change it to what?
I think I'd change it to Nikki.
Nikki? Okay. You definitely can. I mean, and this happens all the time because you look at stray dogs and cats, they can't tell you what their name is when
right.
they get picked up at the shelter, and they will respond to a name as long as you make it a positive reinforcement type thing where you call her name and maybe, while you're feeding her, you can use her name. You can pair it with maybe a clicker that she's associated with, good things with clicker training. And the more you use it in nice circumstances like that, she's going to start responding. And Nikki's a great name for a dog. So
sure.
I think that that's... She won't take too long to respond to that. Yeah, I agree. That Coley is kind of, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Well, that's good.
Very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Yeah, two syllables. That's a good.
Yeah, that's right.
Good choice for a name. Dwight in Duluth, Minnesota is up next. Hi, Dwight.
Hello. See, I've got a 2-year-old schnoodle, and the dog has never liked rotten dog food. And so I began cooking boiling chicken, deboning it, and then putting rice in with it, or maybe do it with turkey, or sometimes I'll do it with rib bones and stuff. And I'm wondering, is there anything else I should be adding to it? I took her to the vet. She said she's in good shape, but maybe a little overweight, so I'm cutting back on her portions. But is there anything else you think I should add or change?
Making your own dog food is an art, and trying to come up with the right protein, fat, carbohydrate balance vitamins and minerals is difficult. Even though your dog as a 2-year-old is doing okay, most of the imbalances we're going to be seeing don't occur right away. You're looking at months and months and months down the road, we may start running into troubles. And as you found out, it's sometimes hard to regulate caloric intake when the recipe may change from one day to the next, depending on what you've got in your refrigerator. One thing that I would be recommending is that you follow an approved recipe for a diet. And there's a group of veterinarians out in the California area that have a website called BalanceIt, all one word, .com. And you can, for a fee, get a recipe from them. And they also sell various supplements and things that you can add to the diet at the appropriate amounts to be able to have a balanced diet. Now, there are other books on the market that have diets printed in them. The one that I tell people if they really want to look at a book is there's a doctor called Dr. Pitcairn. I think it's called Natural health care for dogs and cats. That might be one to look at. They do have some recipes in there that you can follow that will give you ideas as to how much, you know, calcium powder and so on to add to the food to make it balanced. There are commercially available raw diets. Not that I really agree with raw, but if she won't eat dog food that's been processed, looking into some of these frozen diets that you still can cook might be another way of doing it too. And there are diets out there now that are just the base that you can add your own meat to it, and it's got everything else in it. It comes in a package. It looks like a cereally like grain, but you can still add your own meat to add the protein source. That way, if you want to use organic chicken, by all means do that.
Go right ahead.
So be careful. You know, right now your dog's doing okay, but in the long run could be a problem.
And good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Talking Your Pet's Health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor in the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to join in with a question about your pet's health, I hope you will at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. And Scott in Ettrick is up next. Scott, hello to you.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thanks for calling.
Hey, I've got a four-year-old female Siamese. About 3 weeks ago, her liver shut down.
Ooh.
And the vet, the prognosis, he said, was terrible.
Huh.
Hmm.
But anyway, she started now taking solid food and drinking.
Huh.
And moving around a little bit. She's still got a little bit of yellow tint to her, but...
Wow.
I don't have any answer, you know, what caused it or...
Yeah, and I assume that they did blood work.
Yep.
Did they do an ultrasound of her liver or any liver biopsies or anything to see if they could get an idea of what's going on?
No, he took some blood work and sent me home with some tetracycline. He hydrated her.
Okay.
Gave her B and K, I think.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, and this is, you know, when we're dealing with an organ like the liver, lots and lots of different things that can happen. Probably one of the more common liver abnormalities that we see in cats is called fatty liver disease, where an overweight cat, for whatever reason, just decides that they don't want to eat. You know, they've got a cold or they're stressed because there's a new baby or you brought another cat home or you put them in a boarding kennel, whatever. They go off their feed. They start metabolizing their own body fat and it kind of gets plugged up in the liver. I don't know if you've ever opened up a whole chicken that has been on some of these farms that, you know, you'll get the real fatty chicken liver. Well, that's what these cat livers look like. Instead of being like a bright, like a red, kind of a brick red organ, they're like almost an orangey color. And in those cases, the big thing that we want to do is making sure that the cat is eating, which may mean putting a stomach tube in to get them it's the nourishment that they need. Not sure why your veterinarian picked the drugs that he did. There may have been something that made him think that you were dealing with some type of an infectious disease. Tetracycline is sometimes used for treating some of the blood parasites that we'll see affecting cats. And again, I don't have enough information to know why he picked that. I'm glad your cat's doing better. This can be, you know, obviously a very life-threatening and labor-intensive, veterinarian-intensive care-type treatment to get them to turn around.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling and good luck. Mary and Nina, it is your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi. My question is, does Sandy have a list of toxic common yard garden plants, wildflowers? We have a corgi who kind of likes to eat just about everything.
Oh, good question. And I do, but not with me. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Is there some place where I could get it?
You could talk to the Poison Control Center. Any of the Poison Control Centers for people will sometimes have information for pets as well. I mean, doing an online search, I know that a couple of the vet schools, primarily, I think Illinois might be one of them, but will have things like that published, toxic plant lists for pets. I think the big thing that I would be concerned about, and this is more for cat owners, are having things like any of the lily plants in the backyard, because we know that lilies for cats can cause kidney toxicity, or, and they can go into kidney failure. So we need to be really careful with especially any of the decorative Asiatic lilies.
Yeah, daylilies. I saw daylilies can be used to sell in salads for people.
People, but not for pets, okay? We want to avoid that. And Larry's just looking up some stuff right now, and let's just see what he's able to come up with. But
how about like all the nightshades? I mean, not because that's in the
right,
that's a
and
real
those
common vine.
Right, yeah, and any of those would be a problem as well. And so that's why they call them deadly nightshade, because
well,
it can cause.
Yeah, I think there's a couple kinds. One's deadly and one's not deadly, but it's still poisonous.
Yeah, and I, you know, again, I would have to be doing the same looking up you would, and I've got, I mean, we've got a list right now here that's filling up a couple of computer screens of plants.
Wow.
And
yeah.
So doing your homework, and okay. Thank you for bringing this up. I mean, something as simple as even what mulch we use in our gardens can pose a health hazard. A lot of people like to use the cocoa bean mulch. There's enough of the toxic ingredient that is the stimulant that can affect dogs that we've seen dogs become toxic just from chewing on some of the mulch
really?
In the backyard.
Yeah.
So
my dogs both chew on. I've got a golden who eats grass but nothing else.
Yeah, so watching that you don't have cocoa bean mulch
in
your yard.
But that's a good thing to know.
Yeah,
it's a good thing to know. And I just went to the Cat Fanciers Association. I just Googled in poisonous plants, cats.
Yeah, yeah.
That
oh,
one
that's an excellent idea.
Yeah.
That popped up first, and there are a lot of plants.
Yes.
Okay.
So do your homework if you've
Will
got
do.
An indoor-outdoor pet. Yep.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. And Cheryl in Milwaukee, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Cheryl.
Hello. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Okay. I have three guinea pigs, and one of them started developing a rash that's kind of like bumpy with like a scab over top.
Uh-huh.
So I took him to the vet. They put him on antibiotics for 2 weeks, and the scabs and the bumps went away. His hair actually fell out from where the scabs were,
mm-hmm.
and he was fine for about a month, and now they're coming back. So can you explain maybe what that is, or if I should take him back and put him on antibiotics longer?
Yeah, I mean, I would be worried about, does he have any, like, mites or any other external parasites? I assume that they looked at these. Are these guinea pigs housed together, or is this, are they housed?
And they're in a very large, a 3-foot by 6-foot cage that we built.
Okay.
So
and
they have a pretty big area.
But
they're
together.
They're together, and the other two are perfectly normal, and it's just this one that's having the trouble. And it's not getting beaten up by the other ones where it could be getting bit or having any troubles that way?
Nope, and they all. I've been trying to, you know, kind of watch and monitor that, and it's nothing like that. And they did test him for parasites, I guess they looked at. They removed some or whatever.
Right,
and there was nothing there, so I'm just wondering if he maybe is allergic to something that we're, you know, maybe feeding him or that is in his cage.
The bedding or whatever you're using. Yeah, and it could just be the fact that, remember I brought up earlier, treating with antibiotics for skin infections, you need to go long enough. And if they only went for, you know, 10 days, 2 weeks, that may not be long enough to get an infection under control. The rule of thumb is to treat for a week post-cure. So once everything's totally cleared up, the skin is quiet, add one more week to it, which for dogs and cats at least is usually 3 to 4 weeks of oral antibiotics. And it's because the skin doesn't get the same blood supply as some of the other major organs. And so I think the skin gets like 6% of the blood supply. My dermatologist out there is probably rolling their eyes and going, oh yeah, right. But it's a very low level. And so it takes longer to reach therapeutic levels and to be able to get infections under control compared to things like a bladder infection where you can get it under control pretty quickly.
Okay. So I should probably take him back.
I think
get
it might
him
be
on it again. And
yeah, or at least call the veterinarian and just say, you know, it worked, but maybe we didn't treat long enough, and they may actually just go back and refill the prescription for you.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks, Cheryl, for calling. Melissa in La Crosse, on to you.
Hi there. I am thinking about adopting a retired greyhound.
Oh, good for you.
I was wondering, I'm from the La Crosse area, I'm wondering where the best place would be, and then concerns, issues I should look for in the process,
And how much exercise do they need?
Okay. Lots and lots of questions. And, you know, the Greyhound Rescue Association is probably going to be your best bet. And there's local branches all over the place. And that would be probably the group that I would contact. They would be able to find the right dog for you that may already be in foster care, that has been proven if you've got cats, you know, that they get along with cats. I know that many Greyhound rescue groups will not adopt out to people that don't have a fenced yard because these guys do like to run. And they do, I mean, they can be couch potatoes for the most part, but when they're out there, they do enjoy, you know, getting up to speed and getting a good run in. So you probably need a fenced yard. Hopefully you're going to be an active person that likes to go for good walks and so on. But, you know, contacting Greyhound Rescue, and they'd be able to find the right dog for you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Sandy, last time you were on, crystal litter came up as a topic of conversation.
Yeah. That's one of the litters that's available when you go into any grocery store or pet store, and it looks like rock salt, very absorbent, and it sucks up urine. Problem with it, though, is it's quite coarse, and when you give cats a group of litters to choose from, most cats will avoid using the crystal litter. So if someone thinks they're doing their cat a favor by giving them this newfangled litter, they may end up with having a cat that's urinating and defecating in spots that they don't want. So be careful whenever you're making a litter change. Think about it. You know, go by the cat's point of view. Soft, sandy litter tends to be more accepted than anything that's real coarse. And so I prefer that owners stay away from that, unless that's all the cat's been raised on and they're comfortable with using it.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest from the School of Veterinary Medicine here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Looking at your pet's health now with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor in the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Thanks for listening in. Give us a call if you have a question at 800-642-1234 in Madison 263-1890. And Deborah in Madison is up next, Sandy. So let's go to Deb. Hi, Deborah.
Hi.
Hello. Oh,
such a great program. I learn something all the time.
Well,
and
good.
I really use it. I have a 13-year-old poodle shih tzu. And you wouldn't know she's 13. She is very active and playful and generally in excellent health. But she seems to be becoming allergic to every food, a commercial food that I try.
Mm-hmm.
It began with being sensitive to beef, any kind of beef food. And then I thought, well, maybe I just didn't have high-quality food. So I have tried. I didn't care how much it cost. I was trying everything.
Okay.
Now,
what kind of symptoms does she have that makes you think that she's...
In about an hour after eating, she begins itching.
Okay.
And now, if I put beef in front of her, even if she's hungry, she will walk away.
Okay.
So then I tried chicken, turkey, and those were okay for a while, and now they're not. And now I'm trying lamb.
Have you ever tried a hydrolyzed protein diet for your dog? Do you know what I'm talking about? Well, this would be something you would get from your veterinarian. There are therapeutic diets for dogs with dietary hypersensitivities.
Mm-hmm.
They take protein and break it down into little bits that are still going to be biologically usable by the body, but the animal will not recognize where the protein has come from. And so it becomes non-allergenic for the day, or very hypoallergenic. And there's a couple of them on the market, one by Nestle Purina called HA. There's another one called ZD or ZD Ultra, which is a little more purified. They've even purified the carbohydrate sources in there as well. So that would be what, rather than just playing with it yourself, mm-hmm. I think it would be important to talk to your veterinarian about going on one of these diets. And you have to be careful too about little simple things like your heartworm preventative that you give your dog. Most of the heartworm pills are beef based, and so you may have to go to a different type of heartworm preventative that's either a topically applied preparation like Revolution, or there's one that's called Advantage Multi, rather than something that your dog take in orally. So, visit to your vets in order rather than playing with this yourself.
Well, then that's where we're going.
Okay.
One other thing. Recently, I've been looking for an American Curly horse, and that took me into various places on the internet, and I was just struck by all of these places saying how many more animals are being turned in of every kind because people can't afford to keep them anymore.
Yeah,
and I'm so concerned about that, and I'm wondering if there isn't some way for us to set up some network called, like, Share a Pet. And
oh, wouldn't that be? Yeah.
Where people who live nearby could have the fun and exercise. And
they've actually started doing that in New York City.
Have they?
With dogs, where you can rent a dog. And it's for people that want to be able to have a dog that they can take for walks and do things with, but don't want to have all the responsibilities of the long-term care. And, you know, and this is just, thank you for bringing this up. You know, anytime we're going to be bringing something into our life, whether it be that new refrigerator or a car that you have to maintain or a pet for the next 15 to 20 years, you need to consider all of that, you know, what's it going to cost to be able to maintain them. The price of the pet itself is minimal. And in fact, I don't even care what people pay for their pets because it, you know, you can get it for free and you're still going to need the same veterinary care.
Right.
And so needing to know your lifestyle, your budget, and unfortunately with the economy the way it's going, you know, pets are, you know, maybe feeling the crunch of, you know, we can't afford to keep you anymore. And, you know, so be thinking about that before a pet is brought into your life. And it's, you know, there are for people that are on fixed incomes, sometimes ways of getting around some of the expenses through different funding and things. I know even the vet school has a resource called the Respond Fund, which is a one-time you know, grant that you can get for catastrophic problems with your pet if you are financially strapped. And I mean, this is usually elderly or disabled people, you know, just because, you know, you can't afford, you know, your gas bill because you drive a big SUV doesn't mean that you're going to get this money. We're very selective about where it goes. But, you know, that
it can be so devastating to give up a pet.
Oh, definitely.
When you're making a decision, for older people.
Yes.
That may be the main companionship of their life.
That's right.
Now.
That's right.
That's exactly
thank
right.
Thank you so much for your program. It's just great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Deb. Ben in Fremont's up next. Hi, Ben.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I got a German short hair, and we've used, you know, your normal lawn fertilizers throughout the summer, and it seems like, and I haven't I guess kept track of it like maybe I should, but he seems to get sick every time we fertilize the lawn. I was wondering if there's precautions you should take in general when using your, you know, your normal weed and feed and things that everybody uses on their lawn.
Yeah, that's what, all those herbicides and pesticides and so on that we apply. Remember, your dog's going out there in bare feet and is walking on it and may be coming in and licking their feet. Some of it may be transdermal, you know, passage. It may actually penetrate through the skin. That's why they put those little flags up, you know, avoid contact for so many hours or so many days afterwards. It's a real problem. I mean, I would love to be able to fertilize or, you know, do weed and feed in my backyard, but I have no place for my dogs to go. So I just live with the dandelions, and it's like, okay, you know, my neighbors may not think my yard looks perfect, but I'm looking out for the safety of my pets. So walking your dog off of your property, being on the lookout for those little flags when it's a commercial company that has done someone's lawn, and avoid those areas as well. And it's, you know, you may even find that just washing your dog's feet after coming in from being outside, if you are unsure what they've been walking through, may help. But yeah, it's again, being the advocate for your pet and being very watchful.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. And Kevin in Madison, up to you now. Hi, Kev.
Hi. About a year ago, my Sheltie went down paralyzed chasing a ball, and after a trip to the UW vet school, was diagnosed with FCE.
Oh, my, a fibrocartilaginous emboli. What that is it's a little bit of the disc material, the soft center part of the disc. Actually, it's almost like a stroke to the spinal cord where it gets into the blood supply to the spinal cord and blocks blood vessels and causes a focal area of dead spinal cord where you don't get the nerves transmitting properly. How's your little dog doing?
Well, he was pretty much paralyzed from the shoulders down for almost a week, but he's He's come back, I would say, about 85%.
Well, that's great.
Yeah, he's doing fine. My specific question is there any long-term side effects to that disorder? And I'm almost, you know, super sensitive about throwing anything for him, but they say its recurrence is low.
Yeah, yeah.
But he does seem to be fatigued after walks. I just don't want to overdo it with him.
Right. Well, he's probably just regaining some of his muscle strength. Anytime that they've been down for that period of time, you're going to have muscle atrophy. And so he's expected to be tiring more easily. Making sure that he is urinating fully. Sometimes we forget that if they can't feel their bladder being full or they've got some nerve damage that inhibits them from being able to empty their bladder fully, they're more prone to urinary tract infection. So having him assessed periodically for that would be of some help. And again, this is one of these fluky things that it's not common. When we do see it, it's devastating, but it happens in human beings too. People jumping up for the basketball hoop and landing, and it's just the way you've landed, and you get some of this disc material getting into your blood supply to your spinal cord. I'd like to tell you, just enjoy every minute you have with your dog, because you never know when something's going to happen.
And
just, you got to live every day like it's your last and enjoy life. And if your dog loves to play fetch, by all means, let them get out and do that. But be your dog's brains as well. If they're getting tired, then, you know, say, okay, enough for today. We'll build up and gradually get you back to your normal strength later on. And he may never be 100% normal, as you're finding out.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been about 85%, I would say, for 10 months or so. So I think he's reached his maximum.
That's great. And also consider maybe working with a physical therapist. We have them available for veterinary use now that are specialized in the physical therapy of recovery of patients that have orthopedic problems or neurologic problems. They may be able to come up with some exercises and things to help your dog regain even a little bit more of its strength. So look into something like that if you haven't already.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. This might be a time to ask about acupuncture. Would that have any kind of assistance
for pain control? I mean, you're asking the wrong person, because I don't do it myself. This is a specialty in the veterinary world now, and veterinarians are getting certified in acupuncture. But I think for like chronic pain control, it would definitely be something to consider. The interesting thing about this condition is it's not painful. These dogs will it's a stroke to the spinal cord. It's not like a slipped disc, which is pushing on the spinal cord and it's painful. They just go down acutely and come in with no spinal cord pain and neurologic signs.
Very
so,
interesting.
Yeah, it probably wouldn't be very helpful for this.
Amy in Madison, your turn now. Hi, Amy. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My husband and I have two cats right now, and we're thinking about adopting a third cat.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband is very concerned that our older cat, who is 13 years old, it might be too much stress, or it might cause behavioral issues with him. And
okay.
I was wondering if there was any advice you could
give. Well, you've got two cats right now. How are they getting along?
Our younger cat is 2.5, and she tries to interact with the older cat, and he pretty much ignores her.
Okay.
So we're concerned that she's kind of bored.
Okay. You know, you always want to get another cat because you want another cat. Your cats may be very happy living like they are. I think that as long when you bring another cat in, some things to think about. Make sure that you've got enough like resting areas and places that especially the older cat can go where a younger cat may not be bothering them.
Sure.
Make sure that the cat that you're expecting to play with, this new cat, really is a social cat. If she sees another cat through the window and hisses and screams and attacks the window, she may not enjoy having a little brother or sister around the house. You may want to look into getting the opposite sex. There's not a lot of research on this, but when we've looked at female-female cat interactions, they typically are not the most social with each other.
Okay.
Male-male, a lot more social. Male-female, it's a crapshoot. So looking at getting a male, there are many shelters are now doing kind of personality testing. They're looking at what your cats are like at home right now and try to come up with a personality match that would be appropriate for your lifestyle and your makeup that you already have at home. So, checking with the shelter to see if they do this personality testing might be worthwhile.
Okay. And then with the younger one, she was raised in a foster home with like tons of other cats.
Okay.
That foster mom said, you know, we wouldn't even adopt her out to a house without another cat. She was that social. So is that something maybe we wouldn't need to be as concerned
about? You may
not
have to be as concerned, but now with three cats, you're going to have at least three or four litter boxes and be looking at raising a kitten on a different diet. Can you have a place where you can separate their meal times? Making sure that any new cat you bring in does not have any pre-existing diseases. So keep them isolated until they get to a veterinarian to be checked for internal parasites, external parasites, feline leukemia and FIV, upper respiratory problems, kind of go through the incubation phase. That gives your cats a time to kind of date by seeing each other, maybe under the crack of the door, through a crack in the door, and it may not be quite as stressful. Just bringing a cat in and throwing it in the mix can cause a lot of grief.
Okay, that's great. Thank you so much for
your
help.
Thanks a lot for calling, Amy. And Beth in Oshkosh, what's on your mind?
My cat is about 10 years old, got her from the shelter, has some kind of an allergic problem. We've been treating it for a year and a half with a vet. She's been on various diets, and now we're at the point where she was just in such misery that they started giving her shots. Depomedrol or something like that?
Depomedrol, which is a steroid.
That's
right. Okay.
And so she can't have that too often, 8 to 10 weeks, because there's a possibility of the diabetes setting in. Now, I'm just wondering if this cat isn't allergic to something in the house, like, for example, in the carpet. For years, the carpet's been in here for like 15 years, I guess, and it's been treated with Scotch Guard and things like that. Could she be allergic to something in the carpet?
Well, probably the thing that she would be allergic to would be your house dust mites in your house, which everybody has, as no matter how clean you keep your house. You can have your cat tested for allergies, and this would be something that if she's on a steroid injection, you wouldn't be able to do skin testing. But you can talk to your veterinarian about doing a RAS test or a blood test for allergies just to see, you know, if you're dealing with, there's a small little screen that you can do that looks at indoor versus outdoor allergens. I would make sure that your kitty is on probably a hypoallergenic diet, like I talked about earlier, one called ZD, which is a hydrolyzed protein diet. There's one for dogs, there's one for cats, and that would be one to talk to your veterinarian about. Another thing to think about is we are using more and more cyclosporine for controlling the allergic symptoms in dogs and cats. Cyclosporine is a drug that is used for treating organ rejections in people that are getting organ transplants, but we're using it at much lower levels, and it works as an immune modulator, and it stops some of the immune responses that are occurring in the body. And very helpful for long-term management in pets with chronic allergies, much safer than using steroids. Steroids are meant as a kind of a single, let's just make them feel more comfortable. This would be considered something long-term. So
Cyclosporine,
okay. The brand name of the tablets that your veterinarian may have in stock is called Atopica, is the brand name. And but, you know, at vet school, we often use a generic form of the medication. So might be something to talk to your veterinarian about.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Carolyn in Brooklyn, Wisconsin. Your turn. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi there. My mother-in-law just passed away, and we brought home her cat, which is, he's 3 years old, and we have a cat that's 2 years old, and they're getting along pretty well, but all of a sudden this last week, the three-year-old cat has started, he'll urinate in the litter box, but then he'll come upstairs and do a BM in my daughter's bedroom.
Uh-oh.
And he's done this like 4 days in a row, and I can't figure out why all of a sudden he's doing this.
Yeah.
And he has two litter boxes. We clean them every day.
So you have two litter boxes for the two cats?
No, we have three.
You have three total?
Two.
Okay. Are they all located in the lower level?
Yes.
Okay, that may be part of the problem. Cats like to urinate in one place and defecate in another.
Okay.
And sometimes, you know, even though the cats may on the outside look like they're getting along well, cats can be very passively aggressive. And if your two-year-old cat is, you know, maybe blocking access to the basement or, you know, and he may just say, you know what, it's so much easier to defecate up in the bedroom where no one is going to bug me. So I'd consider putting a litter box up there. I know it sounds gross, but I'd rather clean out a litter box than have stool on the carpet. So give him another litter box. Our rule of thumb is a litter box for every cat plus one. You've got that. And spread them out in different areas of your home so that in case they're intimidated by, you know, maybe one time when he was in the basement, the furnace started up. And he's like, I'm not going to defecate down there because every time I have a BM down there, the furnace starts up. And so he goes elsewhere. Also rule out medical conditions, too. Something as simple as impacted anal glands, which could be a result of diet change or, you know, not defecating on a regular basis, can cause the cat to associate the litter box with pain. So always rule out medical causes. So a trip to the veterinarian to get this cat checked out to make sure that he doesn't have impacted anal glands or anything else going on that could be causing some defecation pain.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right. We did change his food to better food.
And sometimes better food is a little bit lower in fiber, so the stool's a little bit smaller, and then they don't get the push on the anal glands, and the anal glands fill up, and then you've got a cat that's defecating out of the box. So that could be part of the problem. And
how,
I'm not saying change.
How is that treated then?
We usually manually express them. Sometimes we have to put the cat on a little bit of a fiber supplement or go back to the old diet that he was on.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. And let's go to Rick in Superior next. Rick, hello to you.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Great show. I got a dog, a black lab. It's called exercise-induced collapse in retrievers.
Okay.
Are you familiar with it?
Well, we do know that labs do have a inherited myopathy, a muscle disease that they inherit that causes them when they start exercising to become weaker and weaker and collapse. Yes. They actually have genetic testing that you can do for this now so that dogs that are going to be put into the breeding pool for, especially for black labs, can be screened for this myopathy, and because there are asymptomatic carriers out there. But it is, you know, unfortunate that your dog has this.
Is there anything you can do about it or no?
No, it's a genetic thing. His parents and all his siblings should be taken out of the breeding pool, and it's unfortunate, but it's one of those things where probably his longevity is going to be affected. You cannot get him out swimming because I've seen these dogs actually almost drown because they become so weak in the water. He's going to become a couch potato and just be a household pet and probably not be able to exercise like a normal lab.
You know, and she loves water, and I've never had no problem in the water. It's usually when she's out of the water.
Okay. Yeah, and it could be a function of temperature. Sometimes we'll see, you know, different temperatures and things can make this worse. But to my knowledge, there's no treatment for it. It's just recognizing it as a genetic trait and try to get it out of the gene pool.
Okay, you know, they have some water tablets and that. Would that help for dogs?
Water tablets?
Or whether it's some kind of a tablet to retain water or whatever. So dehydrated?
No, I mean, if you're talking about like diuretics and things like that, that would make more urine. This has nothing to do with retaining water. Do not be giving your dog a diuretic. That's not going to have any effect on the muscles.
Okay.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, but just be more careful. The next time you buy a lab, make sure that the parents are being screened for this particular disease.
The thing is, you come from a real reputable kennel.
Yeah.
I was surprised.
Yeah, it's something that maybe this kennel doesn't know is the testing is available. And with the dog genome being identified and, you know, looked at, all these new tests for genetic diseases that are becoming more prevalent. And it comes down to consumer beware. You need to be aware of what diseases affect the breed you're looking at and ask the right questions when you buy them.
Yep, and thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Had a couple of calls, one relating to the Animal Poison Control Center.
Mm-hmm,
that person
mm-hmm.
called earlier about that. There's an 800 number, which is 888-426-4435. 426-4435. And then the woman who was going to adopt a greyhound was from Oshkosh area. And there's the Heartbound Greyhound Rescue Center in Oshkosh.
There we go.
So go to heartbound.com and she can find that rescue.
There we go. And hopefully that dog will have a new home soon. So, yeah.
Sandy, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
You'll be back in about a month or so.
I will be. Yep.
Thank you so much. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor in the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Oh, pleasure to have her with us. She'll be back in a month and we'll talk with her again. Tomorrow we'll take a look at canoeing and kayaking with Darren Bush of Rutabaga. Then a recycling consultant, Paul Abramson of Madison, has some thoughts on recycling away from home. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.